everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month.
All right, so this month on the blog, manga of the month first.
Okay, so this month on the blog, the manga of the month is Restaurant to Another World. I think it's an interesting series. If nothing else, it is a bit of food porn. So, I feel like a series that a lot of people have been talking about. And
I didn't even know it was licensed in English, because there's another one licensed in English that's
Delicious in Dungeon.
Yeah, that's the one I keep thinking of, which is not this one.
No. Restaurant to Another World is the one that has an anime on TV, so you'd think it would be, and it has the manga up on Crunchyroll, so you'd think it would have a little more conversation, but for some reason, yeah, a lot of people have been talking about it, so I figured I'd give it a little bit of praise.
And when you started to say it, I was like, for some reason, I thought you were going to say Restaurant Paradiso. Old men serving food
to fantasy
RPG.
Look, that's the next step. You've just got to put the two hands together. Delicious in Dungeon and Restaurant Paradiso, you have a Fujiyoshi classic in the making.
And, of course, we've gotten pretty much, not everything, but most of our Otakon coverage is up. We've got an interview up. We have all of our panel reviews. And, yeah, you know, the last episode of the Speakeasy, we talked about Otakon, but a lot of our blog posts are more in-depth.
That also means, you know what is just around the corner? New York Comic Con.
It's coming up fast. I don't know. There used to be not a lot to do, not a lot of cons or things to do here after Otakon, and now.
Yeah, because I mean,
we've got a huge, huge con, and then we've got that new one coming up in November.
So, yeah, it'll just be like, boom, next month, New York Comic Con, boom, after that, and my NYC. Boom, after that one, another convention we haven't even discovered we're going to yet. That's how crazy it is.
It really is. So lots of coverage from us all the way through to the end of the year. It's going to take up a lot of time. We're also actually coming up on the end of a season. So case closed reviews, SWAT reviews, right at the same time as Comic-Con.
Well, look, man, I don't know. We've figured out a way in the past. We'll figure out a way in the future.
And I'd rather have more things than be twiddling our thumbs trying to come up with the concept, so.
Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing.
All right, so we're going to start with a manga that One Piece Books sent us a review copy of. It's called I Hear the Sunspot by Yuki Fumino. And this is a BL manga about a boy named Kohei who has a hearing impairment, and his classmate Taichi, who ends up becoming his friend and his note taker, and they're in college. So they're just like a little bit older, not a high school story. And actually, when I was trying to look this series up, I was getting a lot of conflicting information.
How so?
Well, so the One Piece volume that they sent us, you know, it's not numbered. So, you know, you feel like, okay, this is the story. And the end of the book, there's no to be continued. I mean, it's not like this, oh, everybody dies, so it's overstanding. But there's no see you in volume two. But then when I was looking it up, there seems to be another volume. And then at another place, it said that it's an ongoing series and that there were three volumes. So I'm not 100% sure what is totally correct. Because this doesn't, is also not, you guys obviously can't see it, us talking about it, but it's not some giant omnibus, like, oh no, that was the original format, but we've gotten like the huge big version of it. So,
you know, I wonder how much, I mean, just from like the little story in the back, like, it seems more like the author had an idea and their, like, agent or somebody, like, pitched it around because it didn't, and we'll get more into this in the story, it didn't seem to be originally written as a BL story, but since, like, a BL magazine picked it up, it seemed to get, so I wonder how much, like, the author pitched the idea and, like, it's, maybe it just, it became popular, so the magazine was like, oh, people really, like, you know, clicked with the story. Could you write more of it? And so, like, you know, I feel like a lot of plans are like, you know, in your Jump-style magazine, you know, you distinctly have a plan that this is going to be, you know, hopefully at a minimum of 12 books long. And, you know, you might get canceled early or extended because you're popular. But I wonder how much this series doesn't, like, didn't have a definitive length, and so it's a little hard to tell how long it's going to be, and thereby, you know, the maybe the, you know, One Piece books doesn't want to say this is going to be two books long, and then it's four. Better to say nothing and surprise people with more, possibly. Although, I feel like the way the manga game is, you know, it's easy for people to forget about series and like, oh, I like that, put it down and then forget about it and not realize that, you know,
there was more of it.
Yeah, and
because it also, the way it ends, it's not, like I said, it's not super definitive, everything is over, but it has, I feel like it has a completed, somewhat of a completedness feeling, or
at least
the end of a moment, sort of.
Or a bit of an arc end, like, yeah, the characters have grown, here was their initial conflict, their lives are not now all perfect, but at least some progress, as you know, with the initial conflict has been resolved. So yeah, no, if like this was the end, I wouldn't be like, man, I guess this series got canceled because it just ended like practically mid-sentence.
And so as far as the actual content of the book, so like Al said, I guess it didn't start off as a BL story, but it's easy to read as a BL story, even without that being the intention, I think. But beyond that, I thought it was well done the way that Kohei and Taichi, we sort of see their pasts and how that's really informed who they are now without being, I didn't think it was just like overly dramatic in the pasts. And I liked that Kohei, you know, he has this hearing impairment. He's not fully deaf. He can hear, especially if people talk loudly, and he reads lips, but he doesn't use sign language.
And he was not born deaf. So he, you know, there's a reason that he hasn't picked up sign language at this point. I mean, he's had hearing long enough that he, you know, definitely, you know, at least remembers how to, you know, was easily learned, you know, Japanese, how to speak and read, although since he's lost his hearing, his, you know, spoken Japanese is not as eloquent as it used to be.
And I liked that they went into a lot of these nuances. I also liked that they went into a couple of different aspects that I feel like maybe you don't always see, because there isn't really a bullying aspect to it, which I thought, you know, could definitely be in there. But I like that it came at it from, one, the idea or talking about the ideas of the world being made for people who hear, and how Kohei remembers how what it was like to hear, and so how that sort of conflict manifests sometimes in the story. And I like that they brought up the idea that the world itself is just built assuming that you can hear things. And I also liked that instead of bullying, it talks about more about people who want to take advantage and not in a way as to, like, con him, but take advantage almost for their own personal, like, make themselves feel better by being nice to him.
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, I'll help you do that thing because, you know, because that will somehow kind of gain them almost, like, karma points or something
mm-hmm.
without really caring about him. Like, the part that I remembered was when he's talking about when, like, he goes to school and the teacher, you know, kind of tells the class, hey, he has a hearing impairment. And everyone's like, okay. And this girl wants to help him take out the trash. And he's like, I can, like, that's not a thing I can't do.
I mean,
and I feel like that also happens in the college where
I wonder how much, because he is very good looking, I wonder how much it was her trying to, like, ingratiate himself and he taking it as her trying to get, or how much that was. I mean, it's a little hard to tell, especially from his perspective. But yeah, you're right. I do feel like a lot of times people are casually cruel to him. I think it's more nuanced because a lot of time, so often, yeah, they're just the snarling villain characters who are like, ha ha ha, I'm going to be evil to a deaf person. Whereas I feel like it, and there's like the jerky kid who does that. But I feel like most of the time people are just short-tempered because, you know, well, you're an inconvenience and I don't want to deal with you. Or like unknowingly cruel. And, like, if you ask them, they think they were being perfectly fine. But, you know, a third-person observer, no, you're a jerk. And I think that's a very nuanced view of things, which I feel really gave the book kind of a nice subtlety.
That sort also kind of comes through with the way that Tai Chi views Kohei, you know, when we're getting his perspective and he starts to recognize how people are treating him and then, you know, the way that it affects him. So, like, him picking up on it and then of course, Tai Chi and Kohei form this relationship, which does become romantic, sort of. I thought it was interesting that the back cover copy, I mean, based on what the mangaka also said, this makes sense, but the back cover's like, more than friends, less than lovers. But in a way, to me, that's sort of like, oh, we don't want to, like, I feel like there is sort of a problem right now with this idea of, like, queer baiting. Like, mm-hmm. oh, well, we're not going to, like, say that it actually is, but we'll just, like, put all these things in it. But, and so I feel like that's what that sentence says to me. But the actual content of the story is, like, I don't feel like it's subtle. It definitely becomes a BL story, even if that wasn't at the beginning of, the first chapter or whatever, the author's intent. It absolutely is. And there's a romance there. So it's sort of funny to me for them to kind of play coy about it in other aspects.
I wonder how much it's also just that's kind of a back copy trope. Like, not that, like, the back copy is written almost like to appeal to tropiness, whereas the story is more of its own. Like, I mean, how many, you know, back copy story is, you know, a different thing. And occasionally those two things meet.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought it was funny. I did think that the romance, I thought it was really good. And there are a couple of parts that really, like, got me very emotional when the characters are talking to each other and they're kind of finally being able to, like, be honest because they've both been through a couple of things and I feel like they find that they're able to be a little more honest with each other than they are with other people. So
I do kind of feel like the first few chapters were written with this idea that it wasn't a BL manga and then it, like, switches in and it's pretty, like, I don't feel like the first part negates the second part, but I feel like when the second part kicks in, it, like, commits to it.
Mm, okay, yes.
So,
and I liked that commitment. I thought it was really strong. It didn't, even if that wasn't the intention at the beginning, I feel like it doesn't feel like it's not supposed to be there. Like, oh, I have to, like, shoehorn this in.
I'm not sure I would have necessarily fully picked up on it if it didn't have the thing. But, I mean, once again, I don't think it's going to ruin anybody's enjoyment of the series. It does make me wonder if there are other books, if now that it has a little more of a commitment to being in, you know, a BL story, if like, you know, I assume that will just progress in the later books, you know, basically now that it's added in the romantic element, it'll, you know, play that up a little more. While I don't think, I feel like still the heart of the story is, you know, this person's struggle with, you know, losing their hearing and, you know, his friend slash lover who, or this romantic interest, I should say, who, you know, kind of has to learn about that.
And I thought it was interesting that Kohei, even though he has had this since he was like, kind of, it seems like maybe like late middle school is when he had this, the fever that caused his hearing loss, that he still hasn't dealt with a lot of it. I thought it was interesting that as the book goes on and some other medical things come up, that he then starts to think about his hearing loss a little bit more and then makes some changes and is still growing with it and still learning in himself about it and his place in the world with it.
Well, I mean, it's very clear that he's super uncomfortable with it, and he's basically able to hear enough that he's basically able to keep himself in like kind of a little bubble of denial. And so, yeah, it's unknown to later events that he basically has to, like, essentially confront his denial as much as anything else.
But I really liked it. I thought it was really good. If indeed there are more books, as we said, we're a little bit confused whether there are, but I would totally read them. I would love to see more of these characters and see where their story goes. And I definitely recommend it. I also feel like if you haven't read any BL before, I think this would be a great one to start
with. It's also a pretty soft start, so I feel like it's a good beginner, like, dip your toes into the water kind of book.
Exactly. And I think the story itself is really strong, so, you know, I think it's like a perfect entryway. So, good job, One Piece Books. Their line of books is totally, like, bizarre all over the place to me. So I think maybe this is probably my favorite of anything that we've gotten from them. I'm glad that they're trying lots of things. I'm not so glad, you know, they also sent us Shield Hero, okay, so.
Well, I feel like they're a smaller company that doesn't have, like, a big connection to a big publisher. So they get a lot of stuff that falls through the cracks. It's definitely thereby really random. But sometimes you'll get overlooked gems or maybe stronger titles that people aren't willing to take a chance on. So that's always gives you some interesting options. I think it's a very interesting contrast to anybody who really liked the silent voice but wanted something in the same vein but also different. Because, once again, I feel like a silent voice deals with a lot of, like, savagery, like really harsh things, whereas I feel I hear the Sunspot is very much probably what people with you know, limited or no hearing deal with much more often. I feel like you'll get the occasional points in your life where you get stuff like a silent voice, but I feel like you're much more likely 11 out of your 12 months to deal with stuff that he deals with. And I think that's a interesting and different perspective.
All right, so continuing on our Space Runaway Ideon watch, we watched quite a bit this past month, sort of making up for Otakon. All right, so we watched up through 17. Things are getting pretty intense. I feel, not that the show was ever quiet or anything, but I do feel like a lot of big things are starting to happen because, you know, we're learning more about the Eon. We also, Cosmo finally coming a little bit more to the forefront, and in a very Amaro-esque episode, I felt that he really starts to experience some of the horror of war and that some of the powerlessness that he feels, and then that really, like, messes with his head, and he gets really freaked out, and I thought that finally we're sort of digging more into some internal stuff with him.
It's interesting because him and Kasha always seemed like they worked together, but they never saw eye to eye. But now they basically both, like, they're both rebels now, and thereby occasionally have to work more together, but they're, like, rebels in different ways, and they don't necessarily, like, line up with each other, so they're still not really fully working together, but I guess we both hate the man, so I guess we can basically glare at each other, but hate the man together.
Well, then they do have that one come together moment near the last couple episodes that we watched, where they team up to disobey orders and go after things and make a big mess, of course. And then they both get thrown in solitary for it. And so I feel as though they bond a little bit over that.
But I feel like when they're in the cages, they still have like a really different attitude towards it. And they're still clashing. They've just, like I said, they're like, if we're both going to be outsiders, we'll both be outsiders together. And then they go smoke outside.
Except then they get split up because Cosmo still has kernels of goodness in him, where he's like, fine, if everybody's gonna die, I will come out and fix it, like, and go and pilot the Edo, and Kasha's like, I don't care, burn it down. No, she does eventually relent, but she's a lot more savage. Like, she's like, no? What? So then you can throw me back in here? Forget it! Like, I totally understand Kasha.
A part of me wonders if how much Kasha did it to save everybody and how much she was like, you know, I do like killing buff clan people.
I mean, it's her favorite thing.
So I guess I'll just join in because I have the opportunity to murder some more people.
Kasha, she's so fascinating, especially when she's screaming Baka in her piercingly high voice.
Like, her and Asuka from Evangelion could have, like, a Baka off.
Oh, wow. I totally didn't think of that, because there were some other Evangelion moments in here. Especially, there's a part where the Ideon screams, which is, of course, very eerie. Even if you hadn't seen Ava, it was super eerie. But it had that sense of, whoa, what's inside of the Ideon? What's causing it to do these things? And that happens after Jabro, because it was that not totally practically taken right out of Gundam?
I mean,
or Jaguro, whatever. Jabro. It was. Jabro, or yeah.
I mean, the only difference is the commander of the base, that the main pilot who's been traumatized by war. The only difference is it's a mommy-type red-headed woman instead of a hot, you know.
I don't know if she was red-headed.
Oh, or brown.
But she was a lady, yeah, like a lady commander.
Yeah, she had more of a mom feel as opposed to, like, the hot Matilda, like, love interest. Well,
she was not interested, okay? Yeah. Matilda has way, way higher standards.
She had a fiance and probably wouldn't have touched Amaro anyway, even if she was 100% single. I meant that Amaro was definitely, you know, wanting to get some of that Matilda, whereas I think, what do you call it? Cosmo just wanted, you know, somebody to tell him, you know, it's going to be okay, we can get through this. Which is what the base commander, before she gets murked. Oh my god, someone gets murked horribly in Ideon. I couldn't have expected that one.
You know what, though? Watching the show, except a few times, like, her death is really horrible because she basically gets ripped in half, and then Cosmo does the rest of the ripping in half by accident. But there's so much death in here that I'm almost desensitized to it. I don't even notice it unless someone points it out or if it's really specifically horrific. But if you watch the show and just watch for people dying, it must be insane. I wish there was a little counter on the screen that was just constantly counting. Because I thought it was totally unclear, too. What happens to that military? Did that military base just completely get wiped out, or?
Because, yeah, it's unclear. if, like, so many people die, because the solar ship is so big that, like, essentially the survivors just join up with the solar ship as they go on to the next place, or if there were still enough people alive that they could continue to man that base.
A lot of people died because, of course, they show up there and the military refuses to believe that there are... Is anyone pursuing them, or that aliens or anything?
But they believe that they had that there were aliens on their tail. But they're like, oh, we're this cool military base. We've got more than enough to deal with these aliens. And of course...
Famous last words, I guess. And then we meet... So we still haven't met the main commander of the Buff Clan, but we do meet Harula, who is a fairly high-ranking member, and who is Carla's sister, and God, she's an asshole!
Well, it seems like, from what I pick up, it's basically both daughters are the next in line to lead the Buff Clan, and so... You know, the older sister is basically trying to get rid of the younger sister so she has no one to threaten her rule when, you know, her father dies. She'll just, you know, basically ascend to the leader of the Buff Clan unopposed. Which is kind of odd, because at this point, Carlala is basically, like, is totally out of the running. And if she just, she's basically like, I must learn about the Edeon, you know, this is where I am. I must, you know, I want to see what these humans are doing with this Edeon. Maybe that's the thing, that her sister feels like if she leaves Carlala with the humans and the Edeon, she'll grasp the Eda power and then be able to dispose of her.
Yeah, I do. I mean, Carla has defected at this point. So, I'm not even sure if her sister is really trying to kill her, or just kill the... Just get rid of... They want the Edeon. They want to get rid of everyone else who knows about it, sort of. And, yeah, I'm not sure she's concerned with her anymore. Although she did go out of her way to humiliate her really horribly in front of the troops. It was really messed up. So...
And, like for a while, the troops were like, I feel really awkward. Can we just not do this?
Please?
And she's like, no!
At this point, Carla is not really part of the Buff Clan anymore. Unless I guess the only thing we don't know yet is, you know, the Buff Clan, more people keep coming kind of here, but we don't really see their central base, so I don't know if she's got people back there who are really like, no! Carla's, you know, super great, or some people that are advocating for her or anything like that.
Once again, I wonder if she's just super worried that, like, if she gets the Ide power, she can basically just come back home and just automatically, you know, be ruler, which doesn't seem to be Carlala's plan in the least, but I don't think her sister seems paranoid enough that seems to be an idea that would be in her head.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, anybody should probably fear if you get the power of the Edeon. Even though we still don't, obviously we don't know what, fully understand what that power is. Although it does, the robot itself does get a new attack in these last few episodes where it, like, wipes out a third of the Buff Clan in one big go. So, terrifying amount of power in this thing, especially when the humans don't really know how to... They still don't really know how to use it. I mean, they know how to use some of its basic weaponry, but anything more advanced than that is sort of up to the Edeon's discretion.
And actually, so far, I don't think they've actually tapped into the Edeon's power. They've just had the super toughness of the machine itself. But everything on it has been, like, human guns and human missiles, because they keep using those Glen cannons and those missiles. I feel like if they could tap the Ide and use the actual, like, Ide blasts, I feel
then
like...
Then what was that power that wiped out the one-third?
It basically, like, because most of the time it just shoots out, like, a few missiles. It basically was able to release all the weapons in the Edeon at once.
and just have them home in. So it was just like this perfect shot of everything at once.
Okay.
As opposed to their normal, like, it was like a super move of, like, basically where you unload everything in the cannon, which so apparently they can't normally do. It might be, like, the first time they actually, like, tapped into Ide power, which might have, like, enhanced that. Because it did seem, like you said, like a little bit of, like, beyond what the suit can normally do.
Yeah, I mean, we've had all these mysterious moments, so it seemed like another one of, like, we're not really totally sure how to do that all the time.
I feel like another character that we didn't talk about who goes through a lot in these last few episodes is Cheryl. Because I feel like she definitely goes through some extremely important moments. Especially when, like, she, like, flees the ship and then Carlala has to pull her bum out of the fire. Which definitely, like, doesn't outwardly change their dynamic, but it definitely changes Cheryl a lot.
Yeah, I actually thought that was maybe my favorite episode was the hostage episode, because you get all these very interesting dynamics about, you know, Cheryl wants to leave and take sort of this skeleton crew with her and take her information, because Bess and the rest of them will not let her do what she wants to do to help, like, the research of the Edon. And then she takes Carla kind of as, like, this backup, like, kind of a, what do you call it?
Insurance policy?
Yeah. Takes her with them, and then they get caught by the Buff Clan, and then without really totally realizing it, the Buff Clan has them and is like, hey, these are our hostages. And they're like, wait, did they just try to, like, escape? And then Cosmo and Kasha have to come up with this plan to pretend to give them the Edeon and then get them back. And then once they all get back to the ship, Carla takes the fall for this defection and is like, no, I forced all of them to go, etc. And, you know, it's this amazing moment because she's so intelligent, and she's like, the only way that this crew is gonna make it is if they stick together. And if they know that these people were trying to leave them,
especially since there are a lot of important people that were part of that crew,
it will destroy the dynamic of the ship. And the best dynamic she can come up with is that if everybody can bond by hating me,
because they already kind of already hate me, so it's not like anybody was like, man, I was so part of the Carlala faction. Who is it named Bess?
I was about to say, and Bess keeps insisting that they should listen to her, which is not wrong. They should definitely listen to her, but he keeps insisting it, but also saying that it's not because he wants to sleep with her. And it's like, no, Bess, the problem is you saying these things because no one believes you. Everyone would probably listen to Carla if Bess would shut up.
She's totally smart, and I'm not just saying that because she has a hot rocket body. Alright, so let's ignore Bess and ignore this lady. I don't understand what I'm doing wrong!
And for some reason, they proclaim their love for each other in one of these episodes, and then promptly never have a scene together again.
Well, Bess is kind of dropped off the map except to be, like, the mean uncle character every once in a while. Because there are three randos who are, like, who swap in as the third pilot, and they just keep swapping in the third rando, except for that one time when there's a fourth rando who just gets murderlated.
I don't understand why any maybe it's supposed to be some sort of commentary on the robot itself or the robot genre or war or something, but the fact that the Edeon has two named, like, major character pilots, and then third person who just is somebody. Is that, like, you know, a commentary?
Because the opening really makes it seem like the third pilot is Bess, and in the beginning he really was. But yeah,
Maybe they have to murder, like, so much more of the ship, and then Bess has to come back to be the pilot because there's nobody else.
Because, yeah, Bess hasn't been the third pilot in a while. It's either those three guys, or if they need to, if it's not one of those three guys, it's some rando who just gets murked.
And, oh, maybe it's going to be Cosmo's new buddy, like the 8-year-old that he says, sure, you should come on a mission and watch.
Oh, yeah, porn. I forgot. He's like, yeah, he's like the new fourth rando who gets that seat. But Kate, he has a blue squirrel, so that obviously makes him a great pilot.
And I love that. I mean, again, I think there is supposed to be, besides that being just ridiculous, there is a, I think, some commentary there, because this kid feels, one, he feels powerless on this ship. Two, he's such a young kid, but now he's experienced all this death and war and upheaval and craziness. And so he's like, yeah, I'm totally ready to go into battle and be on the front lines. And for his part, he's pretty unfazed by the shit that he sees.
Kate, if you've seen the 10th person, what do you call it, disintegrated before your eyes, crushed by a rock or decapitated, you're like, eh, you just, you know, another day, another dollar.
When your nanny tries to straight up assassinate another member of the ship, I mean, what else have you really, do you really not know the world at that point?
I was about to say, that would have added a very different dynamic to the nanny. Man, Fred Drescher tried to murder that guy again. I don't know, guess it's Tuesday.
Yeah, so, I mean, I do feel as though the show's getting much more intense. It's bringing up some interesting dynamics and some really interesting questions regarding war and the dynamic of people on this ship, so I'm really, really liking it at this point. I do have a couple of other random notes, which is, God damn it, why does no one know what a transmitter looks like? And therefore, the Buff Clan can easily track them because people keep picking up this transmitter and then leaving it on the ship.
Or, like there was that one guy who was like, maybe I should get rid of this. And it was like, no, you don't know what the various Eon technology is. Put that back. All right.
No! Like, it's this comical part of the show, but it's so frustrating because it is causing all of the problems, basically. And then Carla and Cheryl OTP, okay? OTP. Not only was their slap fight amazing, but their dynamic after the hostage situation is so intense. I mean, they're very, like, it's like they respect each other, but they hate each other, but they don't.
Well, I feel like Cheryl has that hate boner for Carla La, whereas I feel like Carla La is basically trying to be peacemaker and, like, I'm trying to get you, Cheryl. And Cheryl's like, die in an airlock.
But kiss me first.
Yes. So, I feel like the hate ratio is a little different depending on which side you're looking at.
They are the two most interesting characters. They're the most interesting to see them interact, and I would just watch them talk all the time. They're just really, really good characters. So.
Although, like we've mentioned before, I think now that Cosmo has a little bit more of his own path, I feel like his dynamic with Kasha's improving, and they're both kind of like, it's like, what if the tension about Amuro being the pilot never went away? Because, like, neither of them have, like, refused to pilot the ship other than Kasha for a little bit, but they don't really seem to be, like, with the rest of the crew either. But they're, like, the only two who can get away with that.
Yeah, I'm very interested because that was sort of, like, the last episode that we saw, really. So I'm really, yeah, interested to see how that
falls out,
plays out further, going further, so.
So, although it isn't in this one, I finally did, with a concerted effort, basically playing a mission or two every time I got home from work. I beat Super Robot Wars V, which I remember, like, one or two people were like, man, you're tackling the Super Robot Wars? They're really long. And it's pretty long. It was like 52 missions, so. But.
And how long would each mission take?
It got a little longer, like most, like a lot of strategy games. But I'd say about an hour. First thing right off the bat, if you've never played a Super Robot Wars game before, at least the ones that I've played of the OG, and I know from another ones, there's a somewhat, in my opinion, annoying, but I know people who have played the series kind of like it. They're like these secret missions in every episode. And so, like, there's how you complete the map, but you can also, like, do a secret objective that the game doesn't usually tell you about. And if you get enough of them, you get, like, the real ending. You basically unlock the real ending. You basically, like, complete the last, like, map or two that gives you the real ending. And they're much easier to do after you've beaten the game once. So, I mean, if you're, like, a really hardcore, or you have a walkthrough and are hardcore, you can get it the first time, but the average person basically has to play the game again to get the real ending. I found out when I got the real ending that since I had it on easy mode, they just automatically give you those points and you automatically unlock the real ending. So that was a pleasant little surprise. But if you put it on, like, hard mode, you still have to get those. It's harder and you still have to get those points to get the real ending. Since I just kind of wanted to play it casually, that was very much appreciated. I feel like, kind of like how the new Fire Emblems have that, like, easier mode for more casual players. I do appreciate that, but, you know, if you want to play it old school style, you still can. I think that's a definite cool improvement. When I last talked about this, it was mainly on the, like, Yamato storyline, and when I talked about it, they had just jumped to another world. The rest of the game, you actually spend most of the time jumping between two or three worlds, and you only get back to the Yamato story at the end. So I was expecting it to hop back a little sooner. Actually, it does stay in the other worlds a lot more. And it's interesting that, especially now that if you're on the normal mode, you can get the real ending to encourage you playing more, which I feel like the secret modes did. You can pick different paths. So sometimes, like a lot of times, you know, they have so many units and they have a bunch of capital ships. They'll sometimes break off to do multiple things at the same time, where one group will go this way and one group will go another way to split the forces chasing them. So you can go back and basically take one or two of the other paths that you didn't take the first time through, which was interesting. And it also let me avoid all the cross-Ange story paths. So I didn't have to play that much learning about cross-Ange's horrible, horrible story, which is always appreciated. Because basically, if there was ever, oh, the cross-Ange crew is going that way, I'm going this way. Unfortunately, the cross-Ange guy is like one of the climax bosses. So you basically have to deal with that jerkwolf face embryo pretty much almost at the end. So, and he's super annoying. Because apparently, like, he's connected to all of himself on different universes and different timelines. So, like, when you face him as, like, the last time as a boss, he, like, brings in five other versions of himself, and you have to kill them all in the same round, or any of the ones you killed just repop. And so you basically have to get them all down really low, but not kill them, and then kill them. Yeah, it's like, cross-Ange! Overall, I had a good time. I thought the game was really fun. It played with a lot of the worlds. I will say, man, I knew kinda this was the case, but those games really, really, really like Go Nagai robots. Like, I feel like Gundam robots and Go Nagai robots just always get this. They're like the kind of the icons of real and super robot, and I feel like they get, like, the new shows tend to get, like, their time in the spotlight and to show off, but I feel like there's this reverence for any of the Go Nagai or Gundam robots. They're kind of almost always like the big brother characters to all the newer robot shows that are in there. So I really like, I think I got a lot of them up because they felt like the stately old men of the Super Robot Wars.
I assume you would play the next one if you could.
I feel like the thing is, like, to effectively play them, you have to just keep at it and just do a little bit every day. When I was really close to the end, I kind of, like, did, like, 3 or 4 missions a day. But that was just, like, in the last week when I was, like, the end was clearly in sight. I had a good time. I felt like the translation was a little rough, but I felt like it was super, super effective most of the time. It was even a little, like, cleverly cheeky at times. So it was definitely worth playing for that respect. And I feel like they mix up the units in there enough. It keeps it interesting. You know, you get up the suits that you like and the suits that you don't care about. You know, you can either save for other playthroughs or just not touch at all. Because if you play through again, most of your progress carries over. So, you know, you can just rely on the units you got up the first time and maybe get up some units you neglected the second time.
My other question is, and I know of all the Super Robot Wars games, because there's tons and tons and tons of them, pretty much everything has been represented, but not everything is represented in every game.
Mm-hmm.
So what series would you like to see in the next game that wasn't in this one that you'd want, personally?
Well, I feel like the next one's got to have Iron-Blooded Orphans. I'm really curious to see who they'd bring over. Obviously, they're probably going to have Orga. They're probably going to have... they definitely have Mizuki. The interesting thing is who else. They'll probably have the Blonde Ace guy. Beyond that point, I think it'll be interesting to see who else they bring over. Plus, I feel like there'll probably be some... I'm almost sure they'll have a mission. The ending of Iron-Blooded Orphans, and they're kind of like their big last desperate battle. But I feel like you'll probably be able to save a bunch of characters who otherwise get toasted in that battle, because Super Robot Wars really likes to give you the option to give characters who got tragic ends happy endings. Since they'd been going back to old units, because, I mean, they had Daitaran 3 and Zambot 3 in this one, although they've had that one in the past, I'd really like for them to go back to Tournay. I wonder if that's been long enough. But,
I wonder if, based on the current things, if Voltron might appear in the next one. Either, like, the classic one.
Yeah, that would be... I wonder what the like, how much, you know, what rights issues there are over Golion. That would be. Kate, they could get Dairuger 25.
They can do anything, okay? We basically know for a fact at this point they can.
They could get Vehicle Voltron because nobody cares about that one. But yeah, I'm just curious to see what old shows they dig up. I feel like it's an interesting way to kind of learn about certain shows you might have missed or didn't know as much about.
All right, so of course, you know, right now My Hero Academia is the hotness. Everybody's watching it and reading it and whatnot. And Viz ended up releasing the side story manga that recently started in Japan, My Hero Academia Vigilantes, and it's for free on Viz's site, and now also in their updated app. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah! You can get the free manga on the app now. So, 5 chapters are out, and they're trying to catch up. In Japan, it's not super long yet either. I think there's only about 2 collected books, and then maybe a few chapters past that point. So, we're catching up pretty quickly. It's co-written with the My Hero Academia creator, and it has a different artist. And so, based on the name, it is about illegal heroes, and it's a contrast to, you know, going to school to become a hero and all these sanctioned heroes that are working for, you know, a very strict structure. So it's more like American superheroes who are, you know, on the fringes.
You know, actually, I was thinking, or it's like a different era of superheroes, because I feel like My Hero Academia proper harkens back more to like Golden and Silver Age, like ideals, whereas this one is a little more towards modern superheroes as we see them.
And the 3 main characters, I call them, well, he's mostly called this anyway, but Nice Guy, YouTube Star, and Old Man, who are actually Nice Guy, because that's his superhero name, Nice Guy, Pop Step, who has this leaping quirk, and she also is like a really low-level idol who has a fan following online, but is not like a big, big star. And Knuckle Duster, who punches people. And he's old, and he's totally like a riff on the Dark Knight version of Batman. So they kind of all end up meeting and forming this little alliance as they are trying to figure out what's going on in their area, because people are becoming instant villains through this drug called Trigger. And there's also the dynamic, because they're vigilantes, we have actually the police who are both after them and after the drug runners for this hot drug on the street right now.
Kate, have you gotten up to the point in the series where they tell you the truth about the drug Trigger, that it's actually a derivative of the old drug studio Gainax?
Al, our audience probably hasn't read up to that
point. Oh, I'm sorry if I spoiled that for everybody.
I have to admit that every time I read it, yeah, I do think Studio Trigger immediately. Even though it's not as if Trigger is some sort of word that's unique in any way.
Or like not useful for different types of metaphors, and thereby usable in many different ways.
Yeah, but I do also think of the studio when I see it. So this series, I actually thought that I feel like the first couple of chapters I wasn't crazy about it, and luckily it was free, so I kept reading what was available. And then I thought it got better. I thought, like, 4 and 5 especially were starting to get me more interested. Because I think really at the beginning, I wasn't crazy about Pop Step. She just felt like she was like a fan service-y character and also there for people to rescue her. But I feel as though it gets a little, like, she gets a little more interesting in the like later chapters that I've read. So I was like, okay. And they've kind of backed off a little bit on the fan service part. And also there's these 2 random guys who are fans of hers who are delinquents, and they show up in, I think, in chapter 3, but now, and I thought they were just going to be 2 randos who, like, are
disappear.
One-off. Yeah, because they're, like, getting in a fight, and then Nice Guy tries to, like, break it up, and then they, like, Nice Guy is trying to change his name, and he's, like, trying to explain it to them, because the town knows him as Nice Guy, who's always, like, cleaning up stuff. And he's like, no, my name is Crawler now. And they're like, Crawler? Like, why are you a donut? And, like, there's this whole, like, funny exchange with them. And so I just, yeah, but I thought, okay, these guys aren't going to appear again. But now they've appeared in, like, 4 and 5, and I hope they just keep appearing in the background and, like, having stuff happen, because it does seem to take place really, like, kind of in their neighborhood. So characters, I think, like, background characters will be reappearing.
Well, I feel like the whole thing about, you know, the illegals is it feels much more like Defenders to in relation to the rest of the Marvel universe. Because, like, My Hero Academia has, you know, all these characters with, like, godlike powers and godlike enemies of people changing the world. Whereas, I mean, everybody has, like, really, I mean, none of the main three characters have, like, insane superpowers. Heck, what do you call it? Knuckle Duster is basically, what if the average doof became Batman as opposed to billionaire playboy Bruce Wayne? I mean, he's generally effective, but he still is dude who's trained his body really well against people with superpowers. And he does not have the advantage of billions of dollars.
And they aren't taking on high level. Because at one point in one of these chapters, a high level villain appears. And actual heroes come in and stop that from happening. So I like that they're kind of defining the two worlds. And not saying, oh, these people with, like, these low-level quirks. Because the thing is that nearly the entire population has a quirk. That's just the way that the world works now. So, basically, they're average. Because everybody has some sort of thing that they can do. So they're not saying, oh, no, these guys are on the level of that. But they're taking care of, like, smaller villains. And the trigger drug kind of preys on people with low level quirks and just blows it out of proportion and, like, sort of, like, gets their adrenaline going, and then they, like, turn right then. And so it is like a much more low level story. Also, I feel like this story has a lot more comedy. Not that My Hero Academia is really serious or something, because it's funny too. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like it is a little more like a sort of a sillier story, not a gag manga, but
It's like Knuckle Duster is actually the weirdo because he is the person who doesn't have a quirk.
And we actually learned that because Eraserhead does show up in one of the chapters, and he kind of understands what's going on, and he's at first he's really against them being vigilantes, and then he kind of backs off on it. I was not really loving it at the beginning, but I'm not loving it yet, but I do think it is worth reading. And this is, I really like My Hero Academia, but I'm totally excited to read about some other heroes. And I really, if I could have the side story of my choice, it would actually be some of the other adult heroes that are like actually sanctioned ones. I'd love to have a side story about them. Basically, I just want a side story about Kamui Woods.
I see.
But
not Mountain Lady.
Sure, any. I would just very much love to have some more. I mean, it's a very robust cast. So there's definitely potential for all kinds of stories, which is really fun. But if you like My Hero Academia, I think you'd like this. And
and no Bakugo.
Yeah, man. Yeah, high fives for that. And Nice Guy also, I think he gets better, because at first it's sort of like, is this gonna, I mean, like, his name is Nice Guy, right? So you're like, is this gonna be very light novel protagonist? But again, I feel as though there's a little bit more nuance to it than that, so I'm gonna continue to read it, especially, again, it's free, can catch up and be reading it in time with Japan soon, so.
You know, I think it's an interesting way to expand that world in a way that doesn't feel like it totally overlaps with the main story. This episode's food for thought. This month's food for thought is, if you could get a game based on an anime localized in the U.S., which one would you like to see brought over? Listen to our song! What's your answer to the food for thought?
Okay, so the food for thought is, what game would you like to see brought over that is based on an anime? Now, don't get confused and think we're talking about anime based on games. What we want, or what we're talking about, are franchises, anime franchises. There were anime, maybe manga also first, and then, you know, just get a game because the anime was popular or whatever.
So we didn't get any direct answers, but since there was somewhat of an indirect answer, I will use it to lead into my own list because it was a shared thing. So because, as you will see also in the news section, Legend of Galactic Heroes has come up a lot. Mike Toole was talking about Legend of Galactic Heroes, and Vinny from All Geeks Considered was like, man, I'd love any kind of Legend of Galactic Heroes game. Although he then went on to say he really wanted like a miniatures game. I mean, he said any kind of game.
And there are a lot of video games of it.
But from my little research, because that was when I was interested in, a lot of them seem to be like space tactics games or...
You don't say! Are you saying that they are not romance visual novels?
Look, Kate!
I mean, that would be really popular!
I was about to say, there were like several different versions of Legend of Galactic Heroes, and I remember there was one official version that was just a shoujo version that I'm sure like beautified everybody up. Even like Oberstein was like, hey, what are you doing tonight, Oberstein? And you're like, wait a minute, you're Oberstein. No one should ever say that. But yeah, a lot of them are space tactics games, even like the free-to-play one was. I think the main differentiator is it like complete space tactics, or is it like a 4X game, kind of more like a Civilization? Like, do you just command ships, or do you build up an empire and have ships to defend the empire that you've built up? I think that is the main two versions. But yeah, they've had a bunch of PC versions. They did have for about a year and a half, although I think it recently... closed up. They did have a mobile game, but yeah, I think that recently closed up. That was one of the ones on my list as well, just because, you know, I'd love to see more Legend of Galactic Heroes. And although there might be a, with the new anime coming out next year, an uptick in Legend of Galactic Heroes stuff, for some weird reason I don't see a lot of those coming over here casually.
Yeah, everything that I really looked up, or anything that I knew about, or anybody who already knows me listening to this podcast, you know, most of the stuff that I would want when I was thinking about this question is really nostalgia stuff. And I mean, there is right now a really big retro game sort of love, I guess you could say, or everybody's like nostalgia, I guess, for 16-bit and 8-bit and pixel stuff, and even new stuff that's coming out, or indie games, or a lot of them are taking from the tradition. So I have what I was looking at primarily for this was Super Nintendo games. That's basically all I looked at, was, okay, what has come out and what do I want? And I know that there are lots and lots of Sailor Moon games and different ones. There's fighting games and whatnot, but there was a bunch on Super Nintendo that were just beat-em-up games, which I love beat-em-up games. Just so much fun. You know, hopefully if you were able to bring them over, you'd make it so maybe we could play with like a whole group of people at one time and just beat up everything on the screen. So, and actually when I was in high school, a friend of mine had one of the Sailor Moon beat-em-up games and was able to like stuff it into the Super Nintendo because it was like a Super Famicom game, and it would work. So you could get it to work and see it on there. And I know that they also did an RPG, so I'd love to see some Sailor Moon, anything really.
All I can imagine, though, is like, you know, like the Sailor Scouts are like regular mode, and like difficult mode is playing as Tuxedo Mask.
You're just bumbling, falling over things, tripping. Yeah. You have no weapons.
No, you have weapons, Kate. You have the stupid staff and the roses that just don't do that much damage.
I would play that also.
There are a lot of Mobile Suit Gundam games.
There are probably more of that than any other anime-based game. I think we could say that without actually checking to be sure that that is true.
But the one that I thought would be interesting is the Gurren's Greed games, which is a kind of a joking wink and nod to the Nobunaga's Ambition games. And so they're like strategy games where you have, you know, mobile suits instead of, you know, feudal Japan characters. But they're really interesting in that, they have a lot of, like, OVA quality animation in them. Like, if you just look up any, like, Gurren's Greed game, there'll at least be, like, at least an opening and a few cutscenes with, like, original Sunrise animation that looks beautiful. And they usually, especially as the games went on, put in more and more sets from Universal Century, because usually it starts with the 1 Year War, but you can basically like create alternate histories depending on like which characters you're playing. Like you can have one where like Zeon wins the 1 Year War, or ones where like, you know, this person is the person who like leads the Federation to victory. Strategy games that, you know, I'd like to actually be able to sit down and play. Maybe not, if not the original one, like one of the newer ones. And I know they've like recently remade one of them for like mobile systems. So, you know, that seems like a possibility.
Especially if there's some sort of recent remake of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. I like the idea, kind of like a Super Robot Wars game, mm-hmm. where you can sort of play with the timeline and change things. That seems like a really fun use of it being a game, you know, because obviously you have the canon, but how can you sort of see the different outcomes? I think is cool. Another SNES game is, there is a Violinist of Hamelin game, and what interested me most about this, because it's just a side-scroller, is that, well, I mean, if you don't know what Violinist of Hamelin is, you know, there's battles things, and his group also battles things using musical instruments, but that doesn't matter, because in this side-scrolling game, you carry Flute, the girl, around, and throw her at things. And you also throw her into things, and she changes costumes, and all of the different costumes do different weird things. So there's just a list of, like, all the stuff she transforms into, and that you can throw her at things. So that sounds like pure delight and just ridiculous and fun. And obviously, I'm a big Hamelin fan. very underappreciated, strange show.
This one has a little bit of a story, but a while back, they released a Yuritsa Yatsera DS game that was basically like a little text, like kind of a little visual novel, but it had like you running around on a map and stuff. And I had bought that for the DS, hoping that eventually someone might do a walkthrough, and they never did. But I'd love to play that game just to see what it was about, because it had pretty fairly fun graphics and it looked like a fun game. It was Endless Summer, and it was basically kind of like a little bit of a take on the Beautiful Dreamer, where you keep reliving summer and you have to like break out of the loop by going through the adventure. And I thought that was seemed like a fun little game. Plus, who wouldn't want to see more Lum and Ataru and all those silly jokers? And plus, we're talking about games that will never probably ever come over here, so.
I actually had, a whole list of DS Detective Conan games, because they did a bunch. They haven't done one in, 3 years or so, but they did a number of them, and you get to, it's very kind of, I don't know, what do you call it, Phoenix Wright or Layton, different. There's a few different cases. You go through the case, you find the clues, you figure out the, just detective work type stuff, but with like a Conan skin. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have a ton of detective games. I know in Japan, there's like detective games come out like every month, especially on DS and stuff like that. There was just tons of them. So, I feel like the only ones that, we get a few, mm-hmm. but there's so many of them.
Oh, no, because I was doing some research, and the Wikipedia had a separate page. Like, most of the time, it's, a game will have, like, three games for it, if you're not Gundam. And, they each go to their individual pages, or just the link for, like, a game, a Japanese game that never got a Wikipedia page. But Conan is just like, here, click this link to go to the list of Conan games, because there's no way we're listing all of them in this, like, hub page. It's just too many. Go to this separate hub page that is separate from the Conan page that is just Conan games.
Yeah, and they even did PC games, but they haven't done those in quite a while. I'm actually surprised they haven't done some sort of mobile game at this point. For Conan, maybe they have. I didn't see anything listed there, but I'm kind of surprised, especially this being the anniversary, and it having an anniversary year. I thought maybe that would be one of the many, many, many projects that they would come up with, but they haven't. Anyway, if there was one, I'd be asking for it.
Oh, and kind of in the same vein of the Lum game, I'm a little surprised none of us have mentioned it. If I'm stealing one of yours, I'm sorry. And there is an unofficial translation of this, but I figure I'd throw it on the list. The Utena Sega Saturn game. If you've ever seen the opening for that game, that pretty much sells you right there. And it's really interesting that depending on how you play the game, it has like very different endings. I think it has like 6 or 7 different endings. There's definitely like a ending for each of the, when you end up with each of the guys, and there's a weird anti path and like a true path. And I know there's like a bad, essentially you spark off a worse version of the Black Rose arc ending. So, but yeah, that's always been like kind of like a bit of a, fan wish game. I know that one always sparked a lot of attention of people who love Utena, because I know Ikahara worked a lot on that game. In fact, there's even new duel songs by the guy who the guy who wrote all the duel songs for the anime. He also wrote the duel songs for the game, so it really feels as Utena as you're gonna get. I just also wanted to mention, because it is me, and since I really couldn't put any Typhoon games on this list, because they don't count,
I then have to go to my other go-to, which is they did in the beginning, kind of like Conan, how, especially once the anime was over, these really dropped off. But they had three for portable systems Hayate games, two for the PSP and one for the... Oh, no, two for the DS and one for the PSP. First one for the DS and the one for the PSP were both like visual novelty type stories. And then the second one for the DS was like a card battle game.
Yeah.
But I'm more interested in the first games for both systems. And they also had a mobile game that was also a card battle game. So apparently they really liked card battle games as things went on. But what I wanted was the visual novel stories. Because I know at least the PSP one had a bunch of like new characters designed by Hada and like Nagi running around in a mech suit. So, you know, that's definitely a reason to play that one. The most fascinating news and conversations from this month.
One of the reasons we were talking about games based on anime is because Crunchyroll is teaming up with a couple of other companies to localize games based on anime. Now, none of the stuff that we just said would be of interest to them, I think, except maybe that Gundam game, because it sounds like they're doing probably mobile games. The first thing that they have is like, don't pick up girls in, or whatever the hell that stupid anime is called.
Is it wrong to pick up girls in a dungeon?
That. They have a mobile game. I don't know. Anyway, that's what they have. One of the companies that they're teaming up to do this with is also the company they partnered to co-produce anime with, so I think it's sort of going to end up being a lot of umbrella stuff where Crunchyroll helps produce the anime, and the anime's on Crunchyroll, and then they make a mobile game for it. That seems to be probably the steps for that. So, I don't know what we can actually expect from them. The, you know, that whatever dungeon, I can never remember the stupid name of it.
That's fine.
It
Dungeon pickup.
It's a visual novels type of thing. You know, I'm just sort of, I'm taking my cues from that of what they're going to be going for. But, and I mean, that's the market now, is they're not going to release physical games, and they're not going to release games on the website of Crunchyroll for you to play them on there. So it's going to be a smartphone game, right? I mean,
the only thing that I could see them doing, or I mean, I think would be another good way to release them, and I've seen more companies do it, is Steam, I think.
Oh, that's true.
Steam is a really inviting platform. It opens you up to a pretty wide audience, essentially anybody who has a PC, and in some cases, you know, a Mac, can play your games, which is, you know, fairly high, and, you know, you could then, if something's like mega super popular, maybe think about porting it over to like, you know, PlayStation Store or Xbox Store or Switch Store. But, you know, I feel like if you're going to shoot for one, Steam is pretty good. You know, I've seen, you know, visual novels and other games and, you know, Japanese doujin games put themselves out on Steam. It seems like I know Manga Gamer really has moved in there. I feel like it's a pretty good, you know, vehicle to put out games. And once again, you don't have to worry about physical distribution. I mean, you're going to have to compete with other things in the store, but that's kind of, the modern digital storefront in anything. So, you know,
they'd be able to advertise it on Crunchyroll and link you right to it or whatever. I didn't think of Steam because I think I'm one of the few people left on planet Earth that doesn't use it. So I didn't even think of it. But of course, that is exactly what they would do. Besides doing mobile games. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, they've already announced the first one. I have a feeling they'll probably... I'm kind of curious if they will wait to see how that does, or if they'll kind of shotgun a whole bunch out to see how they all do, you know, of different genres or degree. You know, I'm interested to see, besides this first one, like what's going to be the strategy for the beginning here to see how it goes. boob dungeon. I'm sure it'll be fine.
I mean, my only thing is, like, and if you don't know the answer to this, this is fine. But, like, how much has that show's fandom died out since it doesn't have an anime out anymore?
Or, I don't know. It has 40,000 manga spinoffs that are...
Mm-hmm.
But how well those are doing, I don't know.
For some reason, I'm not constantly on the boob string dungeon subreddit constantly monitoring how much that fandom is live. Yeah, Kate, you're negligent in your duties.
I am! I know that I have been falling down on the job lately.
My only, like, hope... Just also, since I didn't get to mention any Type Moon stuff, is if they were looking at visual novels.
Do you see how I can't even create a podcast that doesn't mention it without Al shoehorning it in?
I'm pretty good at shoehorning it in. But if I were to pick a title to, to bring over, I'd bring over Witch on a Holy Night because it doesn't have an anime yet. It's one of the, what do you call it?
But don't they want it to have an anime? Isn't that the point?
Well, the whole idea is that most of the Type Moon games, from what I understand, are way too expensive for most people to localize. So what you do is you get Witch on a Holy Night, which has the Type Moon name. It doesn't have any porn in it, so you don't have to edit anything out. You can release it as is, and you don't have to change anything. And people can't complain, "Ah, I would have bought it, but you took out all the parts I wanted." And, you know. And it could basically possibly open you up to getting the other titles, especially since they all have versions that don't have the naughty bits in it. So
I think you're greatly, you think people don't want that. Boob String Dungeon was the first license here. You think that they don't want?
Well, I'm just saying, if you did want that material, there are versions that do not have that material.
I see. I think they would sell much better with if that. They got the ones with the material. I would think.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I'm the one assuming things. Another cool project that's going on right now that I have to mention is this Kickstarter for Fist of the North Star manga in a bilingual edition, and...
I feel like Fist of the North Star as a Kickstarter would be interesting, but the way they're doing it is super interesting. Let's continue.
Exactly. So, you know, Fist of the North Star, it's not crazy long. It's long, but not... ridiculous, not Naruto, you know, One Piece levels of long. It's just this manga that's a classic, but sort of considered, like, no way is anybody licensing this in for English and putting it out in a book form. So this company has come up with sort of this really innovative, genius way of doing it, which is as an ebook. Now, this is not just an ebook that you download and then you have all of Fist of the North Star in English and Japanese. Oh, no. They've taken it one step further and you will get a physical book. It's one single book, looks like one volume of manga. But when you open it up, inside is a spread, so it's a two-page ebook that contains all 18 volumes of the manga.
And they have an English version. As well as, you know, obviously, basically it's a bilingual book. You basically choose, you can switch back and forth between English and Japanese. So it is not just like a curiosity for a lot of us that you go, wow, that's a neat book. And then shrug your shoulders. If you participate in the Kickstarter or wait for it to come out, you can get it in English and read it.
And the Kickstarter is kind of both for Fist of the North Star, but also for this interesting piece of technology. Like, it's fairly expensive to do it, but you're also getting 18 volumes of manga, and you're getting this ebook that, you know, you put on the shelf, which is such a fun idea for something that's so long, where you kind of want something physical, but you're like, do I want 18 volumes of manga on my shelf? Not so much. And also, it's in Japanese, so they're also expecting a lot of interest from the Japanese side, which I think is cool. And I just think it's, like, a, such a great way to do it. I'm really, really... And they've already made their goal, way more than their goal, and they have, at the recording of this podcast, they have more than 50 days left, so.
So, I'm just two things. One, I forgot to look. Does 18 volumes stop at Fist of the North Star or at the end of Fist of the North Star 2?
It must be only the first one because the series is listed as 27 volumes, but this is only 18.
Isn't there like usually when they re-release it and like they're probably thinking of like I forget what that's, there's the Tankobon and then there's like the fancier
Bankuban.
I'm guessing that it's 18 Bankuban books. Only fits in the North Star one. I think we could generally guess that they are not including the stinker that is Chris in the North Star 2 in there.
I mean, it says, you know, the legendary manga Fist of the North Star. There's a lot of people who's like, hey, could you also do this other manga? Hey, could you do this other series too? That's not Fist of the North Star related at all.
You know what I would think would be, and it's not done yet, but imagine that would be so great for something like One Piece.
I mean, it's just an interesting, I feel like it's this really interesting in-between state of digital and physical, and it's almost like getting the super thin Blu-ray of that really long series, but you still want a physical thing, mm-hmm. but you don't want it taking up all. I feel like it's the manga version of that.
That, like, putting in high-quality scans and, like, that, you know, it's, you know, like, high-depth, you know, it's not, like, you know, the Kindle One level, you know, graphics, because I saw at least the Kickstarter pitch.
But it's already I think once these books come out and get into people's hands, that'll probably determine if they do something like this again. But the fact that they've already raised enough for it and are way exceeding it, and, you know, I'm hoping to be able to get this also and lots of other people. And so, like, if this is something that is actually viable, it's awesome. It's kind of expensive, but seems worthwhile. I'm just very curious to know, because this is really cutting out a middleman. That's the other thing. You know, translation-wise, I think people are going to be...
looking very carefully how well they... Yeah. You know what I feel like the first thing that actually sprung to my mind was, you know, if I would have guessed what they do after this, it would be Slam Dunk. Because it's also in Jump. I feel like it's like the next title that jumps to my mind of a title that has like just like prestige and cachet in the Japanese mind. And is a series that kind of has like that instant nostalgia. Like you basically tell like the 30 and 40-year-old people in Japan, hey, people who have enough money to afford a book like this, would you want to read Slam Dunk again? And people are like, woo, 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 woo. Because I feel like, you know, certain other series like Naruto and Bleach are a little too new to have like that, like, rich nostalgia. But I feel like Slam Dunk, that is a series that is, like, soaked in middle-age Japanese nostalgia. I mean, could you even think of another title that's like... I mean, the only other title, just also because it came up before, for the more shoujo-y side, would be like Sailor Moon.
But that's, you know, out. So readily available.
True, yeah. But that was still the only one I could think of with the equal amount of, like, cachet. Unless you'd like, Noelle, you're obviously overlooking...
City Hunter, maybe would be really popular in this format. But yeah, it opens up a lot of doors if this is really well done, I think, for stuff that is just so off the table for English manga companies. So, but since we brought up Jump and we're talking a little bit about it, as I wanted to mention this series of exhibitions they're doing, which isn't this exactly what you said you wanted, Al, in that, what do we want at Otakon's 25th, whatever? It's this Shonen Jump exhibition looking back on, so it's like a 50th anniversary of Jump. There's videos and original illustrations and the actual magazines and all kinds of stuff. And of course, there's exclusive merchandise, because what would an exhibition be without exclusive merchandise? And they're doing it, it looks like, in different sections, so there'll be multiple volumes of the exhibit that go through 2018. So I was just like seeing this, I thought, this is what we want, this is what Al asked for exactly. So maybe part of this little series of the tour can also come to Otakon next year.
We have to wait for this to be over, and you know, they've basically gotten what they got out of Japan, and then they're like, I guess we can throw the Americans a bone and, you know, give some of the scraps of this exhibition to them.
They can also give us, apparently, this 50th anniversary smartphone game that they're making that's part of it. Yeah, so this exhibit sounds so rad. I mean, wow, how awesome would it be to be able to go and see any of these? I think they have a whole bunch of information about what each one's going to include, and I just totally jealous. They have some pictures, too. So I really, really wish that we can get just, like, a little piece of this somehow. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Viz could make that happen if they really wanted to.
The only thing that I'm worried about is being Viz, that sure, they do it, and then they bring it either to New York Comic, to San Diego Comic Con or Anime Expo.
I know that that is the danger, but I'm still asking. I know the danger is real, Al.
But you know, we've got that New York Anime Festival coming up, and you know, New York Comic Con's, you know, no slouch. They did bring over that huge wall of, you know, signing boards.
Right, and I think they have that at San Diego, so it could be something that travels with them to all the cons that they go to throughout the year. I could see something like that. Obviously, we're not going to get this whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's, like, please. But maybe just a little taste. And there's a lot of exhibitions going on in Japan. I mean, it's so good that I do not live. I think I talked about when I went and visited, that I realized that it's a good thing that I do not live in Tokyo, because there is so much to do that's anime related that I would be one of those people living in a tiny, tiny apartment, just top to bottom manga and stuff, and just barely like fit in there, because I'm spending all of my money going to events because there's 1,000. So, you know, we've got this Shonen Jump event. There's an Utena 20th anniversary exhibit. It was like the history of Utena. It's like, guys, Utena was only, it's not a franchise. There's not like thousands upon thousands. Not that I don't want there to be an Utena exhibit. I just thought it was strangely worded.
You know, isn't there like a new chapter coming out from the mangaka of Utena? I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, since the first half, we talked about Edeon, and I was thinking of doing a post about this, about, like, shows that are sticky, that, like, stick in your memory. And I feel like, having an impact, regardless of quality, like, stickiness, I feel, is on a separate axis than, like, good or bad. I mean, I feel like there are bad shows that are very sticky and good shows that are very sticky and everything in between. But I feel like Utena is definitely like a really good, really sticky show. And I feel like one of the ways you like a good indicator if a show is sticky is if it like influences other creators with like homages or references or obvious inspirations. Because I feel like Utena definitely strikes me as a sticky series that is like stuck with people. I mean, Steven Universe often references it or makes homages to it. And I feel like it's just, I feel like there wasn't a lot of it, but I feel like it's a series that just keeps coming back and people remember, and especially a lot of creative people, it really like influenced them and like pops up into their memory when they're like seeking things to draw from.
So I feel that's why it keeps coming up in, you know, new merchandise, new retrospectives.
And the other series that's getting an art exhibition is Legend of the Galactic Heroes, which leads us into a whole bunch of other Legend of the Galactic Heroes news. But again, it's this one sounds like it's going to have stuff from the anime, as well as, it says items on display, whatever that means. Maybe merchandise will also be there. Of course, there's some, like, special keychains or something that you can only get at this exhibit. And it'll have cells from the anime, so 35th anniversary of Legend of Galactic Heroes, which is why there's other Legend of the Galactic Heroes stuff going on. We have a new anime that we knew about, but now we have a lot more information about.
A lot of information has come out about the new Legend of the Galactic Heroes. I feel like for the longest time that was like just a lot of question marks. Like people were like, I'm somewhat excited, but I'm also super suspicious that this is just going to be, oh boy, the series I love is coming back. And oh man, I'm glad I have the original. What do you think has been the reaction to the new information?
I haven't really seen the reaction. I was very surprised about how short it is. Not that it needs to be another 100 episodes, because let's be real, that's one, not going to happen, and two, is probably not totally necessary. Not that I didn't love the original and all of its moments, but I'm sure you could condense some things in there. But I guess I'm not sure exactly how they're gonna fit the things that they're gonna fit and where they're gonna stop and what those decisions are gonna be. They've said that it's gonna be 2 seasons, so like 12 and then 12 or whatever. So I'm just like, all right, where are we stopping here? Also, I just have to mention that the event was called Starcrossed. I'm like, oh wait, so are we gonna play up somehow that this, because also the character designs are a little, they're different. I actually, my biggest reaction was to the character designs, which I don't really like. At least in the big character design shot that I saw. I didn't watch the trailer because I was like, I don't really like trailers. But from the promo image that I saw, I really don't like them. Even though I like everybody working on them. But I just thought it was just funny seeing those character designs and them being like star-crossed. And I mean, look, Legends of Galactic Heroes, it's got some BL undertones. Easy to pick out if you so choose. And I feel like they are choosing. They are choosing that. And I don't really mind that they're choosing that. I just thought it was interesting.
But Kate, what would Kirky Eyes do?
I mean, he would obviously braid Reinhardt's hair is what he would do. Like, or actually, I think it's the other way around. But anyway, like, I think it's Reinhardt who's always, like, playing with Kirky's hair in the books. But what did you see, Al, from...
I mean...
And what was your reaction?
I mean, from the trailer, they seem to really be playing up the space opera aspects. You know, they had a lot of ship battles. Definitely, I feel like the emphasis was Yang and Reinhardt. I mean, they had a little, like, quick shot of Kirky Ice. But actually, I don't remember seeing that many other. Like, it mostly just seemed like nobody I would be like, ah, there's, you know, Runthal or there's Dusty. But then again, I wonder how much, once again, star-crossed, Kate, star-crossed.
I mean, Yang and Reinhardt, apparently star-crossed. Sure.
And the Kirky Ice that comes in between them. But no, it seems like to play up those two as the center point and the battles, so, I mean, it seemed all right. Nothing about it like set off any alarms that told me, ooh, this doesn't look good. But like, there wasn't enough substance for me to go, I feel relieved. But you know, it's just one preview, so I'm still on the fence. But I mean, I guess it's good that I haven't like, ugh. Although, yeah, they definitely have, like, changed the character design. That is,
But I feel like, yeah, I wonder in retrospect, like, if I'd been shown, say, the trailer for Golden Wings, would I have the same reaction? Golden Wings is pretty much a case study of how not to modernize Legend of Galactic Heroes when they tried that with Golden Wings.
Right. That was not a good experience. I'm sure everyone's a little cautious going in. I'm also kind of curious how much they are hoping to gain new fans through this and how much it's like, it's the anniversary of Legend of the Heroes, you know, and I was wrong. So the second season, this is why I got confused, because they're calling it a second season in quotation marks, but it's actually movies that will play in theaters. Three movies. So a season of TV and then three movies, which will be four episodes each. So I guess they're like, they're movies that we can also play on TV later and break them up, which we've seen a bunch of lately. We saw that with what was that? And that RPG video game one.
Oh, yeah.
Chain Chronicle. Chain Chronicle. Similar thing. And didn't they sort of do that with Yamato
20? Yeah. All the Yamatos come out as movies, and then when they're done in the movie theaters, they break them up into TV series.
Okay, so that's what they're doing with this.
And I mean, in a way, isn't that kind of the original model for Legend of Galactic Heroes? They came out as OVAs, and then when they had enough of those out, they put them out on TV.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No. Yeah. The first two seasons of OVAs came out as OVAs, and then they put them on TV before releasing the third set and fourth set to like kind of like. So I feel like it seems to be a bit of a strategy with especially sci-fi series.
Well, I have a lot of expectations for this, especially since like everybody who worked on Kuroko's Basketball is for some reason working on this. So I'm expecting a lot of, you know,
everybody has special moves.
Yeah, I was thinking everybody could have that. They could go into the zone, you know, stuff like that. So I'm sure they were holding back in the trailer on that stuff. So that'll be a surprise.
So, like, what do you call it? Yang is, like, in the history zone.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's just, like, just happened. Because it's Production IG, just, you know, Production IG does so much. So a lot of people who happen to work on Kuroko's Basketball are working on this. So, sure.
So, Kate, not to go into too much detail, but I would not think they would get past, say, the second season. But do you think this, like, two sets, do you think they'd end at, say, the end of the first season?
I would think they would, yes. That's what I would assume. With super, super surprising things that happen and, you know, like kind of a little bit of fallout from super surprising thing. And that would be what we get. I mean, clearly they can't tell us the whole story. So I'm wondering too, if, you know, let's say they do this and, you know, let's say we're right. Mm-hmm. Right. And they get through the first season. Will we see more of it? And I'm also somewhat wondering how much, if anything, is going to change in them, because not that I don't love seeing, you know, new animation or something, but, like, what is the point of this?
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to be, like, the same?
I mean, part of me does wonder, because I was thinking about this, like, and something else came up. Like, take something that's actually been remade several times, like Magical Circle Guru Guru. I wonder how much it's this idea that, almost like a Gundam The Origin, what if we, like, shine up the graphics and, like, you know, smooth some of the edges of the story and give it to a new generation that might otherwise be like, ew, old character designs and ooh, old animation. Especially, I mean, I was doing a little research and, like, a lot of people really, like, have a hard barrier of entry, especially with that first season that was done much cheaper. Especially the first three episodes are pretty cheapola. Like, after, like, when the fourth, I mean, that's why they did that movie,
to just essentially be like, yeah, don't watch those episodes. Just watch this, like, theatrical quality movie that just basically redoes those first three episodes that just look like garbage. I wonder if that's the idea, that, like, it's this, you know, it's this powerful, super mature story, but let's give it in a form that's more palatable to a new generation.
I just hope that, like with Gundam the Origin, some of it's changed. It's not just redoing exactly frame for frame the story of original Gundam. And it has new story elements that weren't there before. So I guess I'd want something that maybe had, like, some new bits, something I didn't know was going to happen, or some change to, like you said, sort of maybe smooth some of the edges or give it something else for those who, you know, have seen the series
before. Well, I mean, I feel like that's also what they, one of the reasons that I feel like a lot of the fans really, who liked it, really liked the new Yamato series. But I feel like that was definitely like a series that was written on the fly, and a lot of the older, like, a lot of the sequel stories don't, like, basically have, like, weird retcons. And so I feel like one of the big benefits of the new Yamato is that it basically has, like, foresight of what's going to happen, so it could smooth out a lot of things. Characters who just, like, oh, you didn't realize that, you know, it's famous for, yeah, this guy was always important, we just never had him on screen in the first or second season. They can be introduced at the beginning, so when they're introduced in later chapters, oh, they didn't just pop out mysteriously out of nowhere, or this weird, like, thing that just has to, like, be swept under the rug, we can take care of it from the start. And, like, the Harlock character that got cut out now can seamlessly be brought in, and so he's like a super cool element that was supposed to be in the original series but got cut, and now is in there. So it would be interesting, yeah, if they did it in, like, a, yeah, like an origin or Yamato 2199 way.
But I guess you're right. I guess a lot of it has to do with the quality on the early episodes was just not there, so maybe this will get people to watch the rest of the series. I don't know. I'm just trying to imagine that scenario. Okay, I've finished now. All right, I'm going to go watch the old OVA. You know. But we'll see. I mean, I think there's no scenario in which we don't watch this unless it gets picked up by Anime Strike.
Look, Kate, it's very clear. People will watch this series and then they'll have to see what happens to their ships in seasons 2, 3, and 4.
You mean the spaceships, right?
Yes. Yes. They're really worried about the Brunhild. Does the Brunhild make it through the war?
A natural question. That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit reversethieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.